Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Lance Timbreza, attorney registration number 38229, and I represent Hugh Post and Jenny E. Post Estate Trust and Glenn Post as trustee. They are the appellants in this case and the defendants below. This case presents the Court with an opportunity to clarify what constitutes inquiry notice in the context of mineral rights reservations on land where there is an active mineral lease and the mineral right owner is intended to reserve the mineral rights to itself. Additionally, this case presents this court with an opportunity to consider the ability to reserve mineral rights by way of a declaration of conditions, covenants, and restrictions, as well as a deed. Now, let me start with the language of the declaration. I know the Court has seen the briefs, but I think this is an important part as to both issues. As you're aware, the declaration was attached as a motion, as an exhibit to the motion for determination of a question of law, and it was also an exhibit at trial in the affirmative defenses. That declaration explains the property that's at issue in this case by each of the general tracts of a larger subdivision. And it defines the property to include all of the mineral, gas, oil, and road rights of way. Following that definition, in the declaration, there's an important sentence that says, all of the above mineral, gas, oil, and hydrocarbon rights are to be retained by the estate trust of Hugh Post and Jenny E. Post.
In fact, counsel, I think you may be misstated, because doesn't the definition of the property exclude the mineral rights?
That's right. And, Your Honor, what I was pointing out is that the language is clear on the face of the declaration that it's not going to include the mineral rights. Now, that's
so the declaration really doesn't apply to the mineral rights, because that's excluded from the description of the community property.
That's correct. What the declarations then do is they incorporate the definition of property into the substantive provisions of the deed. Now, imagine, because the declarations are recorded, there's no dispute in the record, nobody has raised any question as to whether the declaration was properly recorded. In fact, everyone acknowledges that it was. Imagine sitting at closing and having that language as a purchaser read to you, that is, that all of the above minerals, gas, oil, and hydrocarbon rights are to be retained by the estate trust of Hugh Post and Jenny E. Post. And again, the language of the declaration says, whatever reservations, restrictions, covenants are contained in this declaration are essentially incorporated into the deed by reference to this declaration, the declaration.
Sorry, Mr. Timbreza, on appeal, are you maintaining that the declaration alone is sufficient to reserve the rights, or are you now arguing that it has to be read in combination with the language in the deed?
No, Your Honor, I think that in response to the motion for determination of question law, at the conclusion of the briefing, we conceded that the declaration in and of itself wasn't going to be sufficient. Indeed, the plaintiff raised this argument that at the time the declaration is recorded, there's no conveyance. All of the property remained vested in the trust. Instead, we take the approach, and the trust asserts the argument, that this is sort of a transactional document case. And there's a couple cases cited in the brief that deal with this issue. One of them is the Motion Motors case, which I'll talk about momentarily, but the other one is Backey versus Owens, and that's a Montana case. The court in that case talked about instruments of conveyance and documents of conveyance. And in that case, the issue was an easement. And the court's aware with easements and plats. When the plat's recorded, generally everything, all of the property rights remain vested in one person. And in that case, the purchaser alleged there couldn't be an easement because at the time the certificate of survey, it wasn't actually a plat, was recorded, the time the easement was claimed, there was no conveyance. And what the court found is that the real estate purchase sale agreement, the contract for deed, the certificate of survey, and the deed all amounted to a documentary sort of transaction where upon conveyance by the deed, this reservation, this easement came into effect. And indeed, the court sought to give meaning to all of the documents, to ascertain the intent of the parties. It's like the Motion Motors case. And in that case, that's the sawmill case, as I like to call it. The seller reserved a right to use his sawmill. And the deed referenced a couple agreements. They called them an agreement and a revised agreement that were referenced in the deed. The deed language actually looked to be a pretty broad right to use. And the court held that interpreting a multi-document agreement The court seeks to harmonize and give effect to the provisions of the various documents so that none are rendered meaningless. And in this case, that's what we're asking the court to do, to give effect to the intent of the declarations, to reserve the rights, and find that at conveyance, that reservation reference to the declaration came into effect.
Does it make a difference that the deed didn't reference the declaration specifically, but rather just referred to restrictions, etc., in general?
No, Your Honor. The declaration was a document of record, and the reference was to any of the documents of record, reservations, rights, as you mentioned, of record.
But there is no reservation of record, is there, in the declaration? There's no reservation of a mineral right there. I think you indicated that in and of itself doesn't do that. So when the deed refers to a reservation of right, there isn't any, is there?
Correct, Your Honor. What the reference is to is the declaration, which then says it's as if this is set forth in the deed. The language that says these mineral rights are to be retained by the trust. And that's of record. According to the language of the declaration, it's as if it's incorporated into the deed. So we would argue that's sufficient. That reference to that language, to that declaration, is enough. But if that were written in the deed, that is, if it weren't just referring back to those documents of record, that would be enough to reserve the minerals. And because of the notice statute, the fact that it's a recorded document, that should be enough here. I want to turn to the mutual mistake issue because it involves both a legal and a factual dispute, if I may. And as the court is aware, this case involves different types of purchasers and transferees. Now, this is assuming there's no reservation by way of the conveyance documents. Where do we go next? And that's the mutual mistake issue. As a party to this appeal, there's only one original transferee left, and that's Warren Jewell. But there are three subsequent purchasers, those who were claimed or claimed to be bona fide purchasers for value. And that's where we get to the issue of notice, because as the court is aware, if a purchaser has notice of the claim or rights of another, or indeed a mutual mistake, they're charged with that notice. They're not bona fide purchasers, and reformation is possible. But if they're innocent purchasers, as the cases call them, you can't reform a deed against them. The trial court here found that each of the subsequent purchasers, and by that I'm referring to the Jabs, the Castles, and Becky Warner as to two separate tracks, each of them were bona fide purchasers. Now, there's three types of notice in Colorado, and these are talked about in both Franklin Bank versus Bowling and Martinez versus AHN, and I want to talk about both of those cases. But let's get rid of two types of notice. There's no argument there's actual notice. Actual notice is the easy notice. Hey, do you know I have a right in that property? No one's asserting that happened here. The second is constructive notice, which is the case to say, for all intents and purposes, is record notice. And then we get to inquiry notice. Early cases before at least Franklin and Martinez sort of combine, I say, constructive and inquiry notice. That is, they kind of say, well, you had constructive notice, so you should have inquired. But it seems that there comes a point where there are three distinct types of notices. And indeed, in Franklin, the court said they are sufficiently distinct, but inquiry notice is sufficiently distinct from constructive notice to merit separate consideration. So constructive notice is not enough. Even if you didn't have it, you may be charged with inquiry notice. And here, we assert that they were. The standard in Colorado under Martinez is that inquiry notice imputes knowledge where the circumstances are such that they would have aroused the suspicions of an ordinary purchaser. And once there's a duty to inquire, the purchaser will be charged with all the knowledge that a reasonable investigation would reveal. Essentially, a reasonable person standard. And the trial court talked about this as being a reasonable person standard. But then the trial court did something extra. It said, you know what, there's not a standard in Colorado dealing with inquiry notice as to mineral rights. And all of the other cases aren't enough. So it fashioned its own standard and added what it called the type of information that must be there to give rise to suspicions. And that information had to be concrete and sufficient. And the trial court did another thing. If you go to the Bible transaction, the Bible Jabs transaction, there was a statement at closing where the purchaser, Mr. Jabs, asked Mr. Bible something about the minerals. Do you own the minerals? And Mr. Bible's response, let me make sure I get this right, was, as far as I know, no, but I'm not sure. Mr. Jazz was then asked, did you ask Jeremy, and that's Jeremy Bible, why he thought that might be the case? And he said, no, I did not ask Jeremy. And then a follow-up question. Well, did this raise some question in your mind as to what the status with regard to the mineral was? Answer, yes. And in determining that he was not a bona fide purchaser for value, the court said, I'm not giving much weight to oral statements, because in Martinez, the Supreme Court seemed to say that you shouldn't give them much weight. Now, I think that runs afoul of Martinez. Martinez is an interesting case because there was at both the trial court and court of appeals level, the purchaser was found to be a bona fide purchaser. This case involved some mortgage-type transaction where the seller was going to save the buyer in case of a default. And it was the underlying agreement was fraudulent. And the Court of Appeals and the trial court said, well, even if they discovered the agreement, they wouldn't have discovered that it had a fraudulent undertone. And the Supreme Court said, no, they would have. But there were some things that they could have looked at. And the Supreme Court said there were two back-to-back quitclaim deeds, which in and of itself is not enough to raise a duty to inquire, but certainly two back-to-back might. There was also the underlying agreement. There was possession by the actual owner of the property, and the realtor went there, and the owner said, hey, this is my house, I don't want to sell it. And the trial court of appeals said, well, that's just buyer's remorse. She didn't want to sell it anymore. And the court of appeals said, no, that oral statement is relevant to inquiry notice. Now, it didn't go too much into the oral statement because it said there's enough other information other than remanding to have a look back at the oral statement or basing our reversal on it, but it didn't discount them. And I think that the trial court was wrong in saying that you don't give weight of credibility to them. And in that case, it was important.
Well, recognizing, as the trial court said, that the Jabs presents a very close case. Ultimately, isn't it a factual finding by the trial court that what Jabs was told at closing didn't trigger inquiry notice?
Your Honor, first of all, I think there's a question about the appropriate standard, which is a question of law. And then there has to be application of facts. Even if the court finds that the trial court's facts were sufficient, it can apply those facts to the appropriate standard.
Okay, well, I'm not sure how you distinguish what you contend is the appropriate standard from what the trial court applied here. The trial court said it has to be concrete and sufficient. Well, wouldn't sufficiency always be a part of the standard?
Sufficiency maybe. I don't think it has to be concrete because, again, cases like Martinez, some of the other inquiry notice cases, Jaramillo versus McCloy, dealt with these conversations. If there was anything that would give rise to suspicions to lead one to inquire. Now, if they inquired, there wouldn't be anything else, and found that nothing existed, no harm, no foul. But I think the court here can take the facts that the trial court found, apply them to the legal standard, and reverse the trial court on these transactions. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
So, a quick question. Is there any dispute that the oil and gas lease was entered into in 1985 had expired by its terms in 1990?
The testimony at trial was that the Exhibit 1, I believe, was the oil and gas lease that the royalties were being drawn from. That is, it is a recorded, unexpired gas lease. And there's language in the gas lease that says it either expires in 5 years or if drilling happens, it continues. It was of record. Nobody inquired about it. Thank you.
Good afternoon. William DeFord of the law firm of Dufford, Waldeck, Milburn, and Crone, appearing for the plaintiff, Appellees. I'm going to limit my comments, questions on the other issues, to just a couple issues that came up in the reply brief. The first one is this notion that the deeds incorporated the declaration by reference. Mr. Timbresa talked about this idea of transaction documents and how there were several documents that formed part of this transaction. This really comes down to the issue of whether the declaration was incorporated by reference in the deeds. Mr. Timbresa has cited numerous cases in the briefs in which a deed incorporates by reference a number of agreements, plats, leases, other documents, and that those documents can become binding on the purchaser because they were incorporated by reference. The cases, though, that he cites show why such a thing didn't happen in this case. It didn't happen in this case for two reasons. The declaration doesn't clearly provide for a severance of the mineral rights. Judge Miller, as your questions indicated, it's undisputed here that the declaration alone did not create a mineral reservation, and therefore there was no reservation of record at the time that the deeds were entered into. The deed has some language in the warranty clause saying that the sellers warrant title to the property subject to, among other things, reservations of record. But the declaration was not a reservation of record, and that doesn't seem to be in dispute here. So there certainly wasn't in any of the deeds any specific incorporation by reference of the provisions of the declaration. There was no, in the grant section of the deed, there was no reference, for example, to the reservation of mineral rights contained in a declaration of covenants at reception number such and such. But the cases cited by Mr. Timbresa do have such incorporations by reference in the deed. For example, the Backe case, which formed an important part of the briefing here, and that's the Montana case where there was a certificate of survey. In that case, the issue was whether an easement had been created in a neighborhood, and both the warranty deed and the sales contract described the property being conveyed by meets and bounds, and then both documents refer to the property conveyed as Tract 2, shown on Certificate of Survey Number 1657, Records of the Lincoln County Clerk and Recorder. A specific incorporation there. Subject to, this is, again, in the grant section of the deed in the Backe case, subject to the provisions contained in that certificate of subdivision plat approval. Again, it lists a file number and where it was recorded. The deed identified and incorporated that certificate of survey. And then the court found in that case that the certificate of survey, quote, identifies the easement clearly and specifically. In addition to all of this, in that case, there was a Montana statute that specifically provides for this procedure of recording the certificate of survey in the public land records and incorporating it by specific reference in the deed. All of this was done pursuant to a Montana statute that provides for exactly that what occurred. And so it was a pretty easy case to say that the easement shown in that certificate of survey was binding on the purchasers. Here, we don't have it clearly in the declaration that the minerals are severed. We don't have it clearly on the deed that there's any incorporation of such severance. We don't have any reception number. We don't have any location where this thing was recorded. All we have is that the seller warrants title to the property subject to reservations of record.
And counsel, let's assume you're right on that issue. There's still the question of whether or not the plaintiffs, who are subsequent purchasers, took their title subject to inquiry notice.
Yes.
And an issue that we've discussed earlier is the Mr. Bible's statement to Mr. Jabs that he didn't think that the mineral rights were going to go to Mr. Jabs. Didn't Mr. Jabs have an obligation at that point to inquire further what that meant?
Well, at that point, I believe the language was Mr. Jabs asked Mr. Bible whether the minerals were included in the transaction. Mr. Bible said, as far as I know, no, but I'm not sure. Further questions, when you're told that they don't know, that they're not sure, further questions are unlikely to net any kind of information. Now, at trial, after Bible had had a chance to review his sales contract that had a reservation language in it, he was able to say, yes, I remember now, that we had agreed previously that the minerals would be reserved by the trust. So at the time of closing, years after he bought the property, I believe, Bible told Jabs, I'm not sure. And so the reason why this is the inquiry notice is a fact issue here. Mr. Timbrasa said that it's a mixed question of law and fact. The reason why it's a fact issue is the trial court took into account what kinds of suspicion were aroused in the plaintiffs. Remember that inquiry notice is circumstances that arouse suspicion in a reasonable buyer such that they would make a further inquiry, and they are charged with whatever that inquiry would have uncovered. The trial court examined the facts surrounding that suspicion, whether there would be any suspicion in the minds of these buyers that the mineral rights had been previously reserved by some unrecorded agreement. And the trial court, in essence, ruled that even if there was suspicion that, for example, in the Bible Jabs transaction, that the mineral rights had been reserved, there was no suspicion at all that they had been reserved by some sort of unrecorded deal or some mutual mistake. And so if Jabs had made a further inquiry, it would have been, he tells me he's not sure whether there's a reservation. I'm going to look in the land records and find out. And he would have found in the land records that, in fact, the deed had no reservation of minerals in it.
Oh, but constructive notice requires looking in the land records, but doesn't inquiry notice require some other inquiry? Well, I mean, if, for example, there was a swimming pool in the back and Mr. Jabs had asked, does that swimming pool come with the property? And Mr. Bible had said, I think so, but I'm not sure. Wouldn't he have done something at that point to try to find out if it was important to him? And I think he testified here that the mineral rights were important to him.
And what the trial court did in this case was to say, look to the kinds of suspicion that these circumstances would arouse and what kind of an inquiry that suspicion would lead to. So for example, if there's a suspicion only that there might have been a reservation at some point in the chain of title, then the inquiry would have been to look in the land records. If there was suspicion that there was somehow an unrecorded interest here, then the inquiry that the buyer would be charged with is to look for unrecorded interests. And I can give you an example. The Post Trust has relied on the case Thomas & Son Transfer Line versus Kenyon Incorporated. And in that case, buyers contracted to purchase some property. There was a tenant living in that property, in possession of the property. There was an unrecorded lease for that tenant that included a holdover provision. It was a holdover tenant. In that case, the buyer was specifically on inquiry notice that there would be an unrecorded lease. Clearly, there was no recorded lease, and there was a tenant in the property. And so the kinds of suspicion that were aroused in the buyer was such that they would know that there may be an unrecorded interest in the property. In this case, we don't have that. There was no notice at all to any of the plaintiffs that there might be some side deal, some understanding, some language in the sales contract that was not recorded that provided for reservation of the minerals. And so an ordinary buyer, if they were wondering whether the minerals had been reserved, would not look beyond the land records because they had no suspicion that there was any unrecorded interest. This is how inquiry notice is distinct from constructive notice. If it's here, essentially, it was that they had no idea that there might be an unrecorded interest, and therefore they didn't look beyond the land records, and they shouldn't be charged to look beyond the land records.
And Mr. Bible, though, said no, but I'm not sure. There was no follow-up question about, well, why do you think no? Because, I mean, it just dropped off, right?
Yes.
And so if he had asked, why do you think no, maybe there would have been some hint about an unrecorded interest or something of that nature.
Unfortunately, the record is unclear on that issue, that Bible even knew at that time that his sales contract provided for that. At trial, he had clearly reviewed his sales contract before he testified, and he was able to testify about the sales contract that contained language about the reservation. But the defendants did not place in the record that Bible knew at that time that there was this language in the sales contract and could have then responded to any questions about it. Unfortunately, the record just doesn't tell us that that's the case, and therefore we have to go on that statement. I'm not sure.
If we were to conclude that the lower court applied a wrong standard, and in fact there was inquiry notice, should we remand for further findings as to what that inquiry notice might reasonably be expected to produce?
At that point, I think even if there was inquiry notice, there are specific factual findings in the record about what that inquiry would have disclosed. Now, and that is the trial court determined that search of the land records
I think you're conflating the two. I mean, the land records are what they are, and they dictate constructive notice. So if we were to conclude that there was inquiry notice, doesn't that leave open the necessity for the lower court to make further factual findings as to what inquiry notice, in addition to what's in the chain of title, might have revealed?
Yes, it's possible. It depends on, again, since this is a factual issue, it's going to depend on what kind of suspicion was aroused or would be aroused in a reasonable buyer. And therefore, that would determine what kinds of inquiry would have been necessary.
Well, isn't the suspicion I might not be getting the mineral interests? I guess I don't understand how you can parse that as a matter of degree. Either he gets the mineral interests or he doesn't. And his seller told him, I'm not, probably not, but I really don't know.
Well, what I'm saying is the suspicion is whether there may be an unrecorded interest in this property or whether there was a suspicion that there was a reservation somewhere in the chain of title.
All right, and isn't the response to that then to ask the people involved about an unrecorded transaction?
That could be if you know, again, that's a factual issue, and so maybe the trial court would have to make factual findings on what they would have found had they looked for an unrecorded interest in the property.
Ask you about the lease, the oil and gas lease.
Yes.
I think you represented that it was in your briefing that it was undisputed that that had expired by its terms. Is that? I think counsel was maybe disagreeing with that.
No.
The lease itself is illegible, the copy that's in the record. What is the story on that?
If I gave that impression, I apologize. Okay. Because the lease is currently being produced under.
The same lease.
Okay. Yes, the same.
And not expired by its terms.
That's right.
Thank
you. The trial court did say that there was language in the lease, in the habendum clause, ordinary language in the lease that says that if it's not developed in 5 years, then it expires by its terms. And she was making findings regarding whether that lease put anyone on inquiry notice. She said no.
And none of these purchasers were aware that there was production ongoing at the time?
That's right.
Your Honors, just a few brief points. The first one is the Backe case. Just want to point out, it wasn't an easy case. It was a 5-3 decision, And the issue in that case was whether the statute referred had been followed. It had not. And the court said, we're putting form over substance. We are going to bring about the intent of the documents. I also want to address Thomas's son transfer in line, and it is a case we relied on in the brief. That case involved an unrecorded lease that was expired. The seller says it's an expired lease, and the court still found a duty to inquire. Here, there was a lease of record, Exhibit 1, and the lessee was never called. The trustee was never called. Jeremy Miller versus McCloy has a line, and the court says Kilgore, who was the alleged bona fide purchaser, simply closed his eyes and left the entire matter to his lawyer. And Thomas and Son transfer line, that case as well, they stand for one proposition, and that's a duty to do due diligence, to inquire and determine what you're getting. And we know from the cases that's more than just looking at the record. Thank you.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Were we to conclude that the lower court applied the wrong standard, should we remand for further findings on what inquiry notice reasonably would have uncovered?
Yeah, I think there's sufficient facts in the record from the testimony of parties and even the findings of fact from the trial court that this court could apply those facts to the standard and reach a conclusion that would reverse the trial court without remanding. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.